to everyone but you. And when I do, I'll see you standing there. I'll lock my heart to any other caress. I'll never say yes to a new love affair. Then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day.
That's my reaction to a system that requires customers to buy groceries by running their finger over a scanner. Fingerprint shopping is being tested at grocery stores across the country. In a program system, your fingerprint is linked to your credit card or bank account. At best, fingerprint matching is only 80% accurate, and all technology can be compromised. Who takes the print to set up your account? A checker trained in biometrics? Hardly. Where are the laws that define the purchase, sale, or transfer of these unique parts of your body to others? And where's the time-saving factor? You still have to key in a code, sign a receipt, and say paper or plastic. I'm Mari Frank, co-host of Privacy Piracy. To learn more about this issue and other privacy issues, join us on Wednesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Your attention, please. This is required listening information for all KUCI 88.9 FM radio frequency and KUCI.org broadband recipients. Weekly Signals with Mike Kaspar and Nathan Callahan, a one-hour irreverent reality-based mashup of contemporary events, commentary, and interviews, broadcasts every Tuesday beginning at 8 a.m. sharp. You may choose to listen to Weekly Signals Weekly Review, Seymour Hersh, Garrison Keillor, Terry Jones, and Ariana Huffington, to name a few, on demand, online at weeklysignals.com, or live during the Weekly Signals Tuesday morning 8 a.m. time slot. However you choose, your listening is required. Again, that's KUCI Weekly Signals Tuesdays, 8 a.m., and so on.
Yeah, Riders on Riding, every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time. Yeah, the dirt on publishing, writers, authors, all of it. Listen.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello and welcome again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org, and we are on iTunes. Go to Radio, Public Radio, KUCI, and listen immediately. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm happy to be here once again. Today we have with us Mary Roach and Kathleen Shine. First up is Mary Roach. She's the author of the New York Times bestsellers Stiff, The Curious Lives of Human Cadavers, and Spook, Science Tackles the Afterlife. Stiff was a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers pick for 2003, and Spook was named a New York Times Notable Book for 2005. Mary's work has appeared in Outside, Wired, National Geographic, GQ, and the New York Times Magazine. She's a former columnist at Salon.com and contributing editor at the science magazine Discover. She has always gravitated toward the peculiar, covering subjects such as Eskimo food, flatulence, vaginal weightlifting, carrot addiction, and amputee bowling leagues. She lives in Oakland with her husband, Ed, and her books have been translated into 16 languages. She's here today to talk about Bonk, the curious coupling of science and sex. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Great to have you on. First of all, I love the title of your new book. Will you talk about how that came about?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, Bonk is one of the slang words for sex, and it seemed to be, given the alternatives, that this one, you know, it suggested sex. It suggested that it was, you know, kind of a little irreverent, maybe a little edgy, possibly, but it wasn't outright vulgar as, you know, screw would have been. I kind of liked hump, but my publisher disagreed, but felt that hump was a little unsavory.
Yeah.
And boink would have been okay, but boink was a little cartoony for me. People feel very strongly. There's some people who feel very strongly the book should be called Boink, and I, like, encourage them to draw in the eye on the cover. I won't be offended.
Well, also, the cover of the book, it's so subtle, and yet if you take a look at it with these ladybugs on the O, did you have any say in the cover art here?
Do I have any say in it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, they always solicit your opinion as a writer, as an author, but ultimately, if you hate it and they love it,
yeah.
Tough caca.
Right.
I happen to really like this cover, but, I don't have any veto power or anything, so if I hadn't liked it, it wouldn't have made that much difference.
Well, it's great because, again, it's subtle enough that you can carry the book and not worry about people staring at you on the subway.
That's a concern. You know, people, they thought, well, sex sells, but I don't know. With a nonfiction book, does it maybe just make people uncomfortable to walk up to the checkout counter if there were, you know, naked bodies entwined on the cover? They did market research, and they did have a cover that was kind of an unappealing-looking cover with legs. Four legs kind of entwined with EKG electrodes on them, and everyone hated it.
Well, this is great, and your writing, as usual, is entertaining and informative. I'm curious, though, how you came up with the topic.
Oh, that was, I actually remember the exact moment. I was reading an old back issue of Film Quarterly, and I don't know why, because I don't subscribe to Film Quarterly. I don't know where I came across it, but I was flipping through it, and I came across this reference to the films of Masters and Johnson, and these were actually films made using a penis camera to film a woman's sexual response from inside her body. And I remember thinking, sex research, that's got to be the next book, you know, because I love to do, basically I like to cover things going on in the world of science and in laboratories that you wouldn't really expect to be in laboratories. So this seemed like a fruitful area. So that was really the moment where I thought, that's the next book.
Hmm. Interesting. Let's back up a little bit and talk about how you got into the genre that you write in right now, which is sort of like a fun, irreverent science.
You know, I think, like most things in my career, it was fairly random, and I was fairly passive about it. I started out writing for this magazine, Hippocrates, which was a really good magazine of health and medicine and science, and it was, this is in the early 80s, mid-80s, sorry, and it, that magazine got a fair amount of awards, and so somebody from the science magazine discovered, an editor just called and said, hey, do you want to write about science? And I said, yeah, hey, why not? Sure. and then I guess coupling that with, so to speak, combining that with my, I have this sort of a short attention span, and I tend to wander out to the fringes of whatever area I'm researching, and I stumbled on, you know, I guess I was attracted to the less frequently covered material, the taboo stuff or the weird stuff, or I think I landed in science haphazardly, and then my own personality took me to the places that I end up writing about.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I am with Mary Roach, whose new book is Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, published by Norton. So let's back up probably even a little more in terms of your topic interest, because in your bio, you know, amputee bowling leagues and you know, the weird stuff that you're interested in, mm-hmm. that other writers may not know is so interesting until you do it, and then, like, why didn't I think of that? how did that happen? How did sort of your subjects pop out?
I'm trying to, you know, I part of a lot of those amputee bowling leagues, carrot addiction, the Eskimo food, those are all when I was writing for Salon.com, which Salon.com is still around, but in their early years, they were, you know, quite, they were doing very well, and they were, a lot of people were reading them, they were wonderful to write for, because they essentially turned you loose and said, just write about whatever you want. However, we'll be looking at your hit rates, and if they're, they're not very high, we're going to suggest that you change direction or go away. So I had a column, and I was shaped partly by my own curiosity, but partly by what seemed to intrigue people. And the cadaver book actually was an offshoot of the Salon column, because I'd done three pieces about cadavers in research. One of them was about cadavers being used to calibrate crash test dummies. Another one was a Thanksgiving column about how much you could eat before your stomach would explode. And, which I thought was a perfect holiday piece. And those got very high hit rates. And I thought, okay, so other people, it's not just me. It's not just me that's strange. Apparently, a lot of people find this kind of topic interesting. So that was, you know, all the encouragement I needed to, I heard about this bowling league of all double and triple amputees, and they invited me to a bowling party, and they're called Stumps R Us is the group, and they invite, and I thought, wow, this door opening up to this world that I'd never really thought about, certainly never been to, and I couldn't resist, and so, you know, that, I guess this is just a part of my sense of curiosity, and along with the encouragement of Salon.com to, you know, go out and do it, you know, gather the research, whatever appeals to you, with an eye toward it being sort of appealing to other people's sort of curiosity, too.
Yeah, that's great stuff. Will you read to us from Bonk?
I'm sorry, this is a sort of a difficult connection for me
difficult to hear
you
on. Difficult to hear me? Could you read from Bonk?
Oh, yeah, sure. Of course. There's a couple of footnotes that I love to read. So I'm going to read.
Sure.
The footnotes, people often feel, are the best part of my book. So for this book, there's twice as many footnotes as there was in Stiff, possibly to the point of distraction. This is a footnote about, it's about a urologist named Giles Brindley, who did some quite groundbreaking sex research, and this is a description of him presenting his findings. Okay. At a 1983 urology conference, Brindley delivered a lecture about a new impotency drug, papaverine, that produced robust erections when injected directly into the penis. He began by showing his audience, a group of around 80 urologists and their wives, many en route to the conference cocktail party and dressed in formal attire, a series of slides of his own penis after various dosages. He then revealed that 5 minutes earlier he had injected himself with papaverine. He pulled the fabric of his tracksuit tightly against his hips to reveal the outline of his medicated member. Not satisfied, he then pulled down his pants, revealing, in the words of eyewitness Lawrence Klotz, quote, a long, thin, clearly erect penis. Klotz's account of the event was published in British Journal of Urology International in 2005. And now we have a continuation of Klotz's description. Brindley paused, seeming to ponder his next move. The sense of drama in the room was palpable. He then said with gravity, "I'd like to give some of the audience the opportunity to confirm the degree of tumescence." With his pants at his knees, he waddled down the stairs. As he approached the audience, erection waggling before him, four or five of the women in the front rows threw their arms up in the air and screamed. The screams seemed to shock Professor Brindley, who rapidly pulled up his trousers and terminated the lecture.
That's great. That's great.
I like that passage because it's this. It's a nice example of some of the challenges that researchers face. I mean, here's a guy who's got he's stumbled onto this very effective drug that creates erections in men, and he's very obviously very excited about telling his colleagues, and what better way than to show them? But you know, I guess the exuberance just kind of got ahead of him, and he didn't really think it through, or he forgot about the wives.
Now, talk about, you know, just the aspect of using footnotes as well as graphics and photos, because I found those three things to be really wonderful parts of the book and not typically parts of books.
Yeah, the footnotes have to do with my ability to constantly distract myself while I'm working. I'll be working on something and I'll think, you know, some word or some element of the research that I'm doing will trigger another, send me off on a tangent, and I can't help myself, and I follow up those tangents, and then I think, well, this would take a very, very long parenthetical, and longer than anybody would be willing to put up with. So, and I can't bear to lose it because it's so fun.
Mm-hmm.
So I stick it at the bottom of the page. The Brindley footnote, probably if I worked hard enough, I could have fit Brindley in elsewhere in his own proper paragraph. But I didn't. But very often it's things that don't even have to do with sex, but I've come across them. For example, there was a guy that I was talking to at a gathering that had to do with sex, but his other job was he dealt with marine waste. And I looked him up on the web to verify the name of his company, and it was his slogan was number one in the number two business. And I thought, how many other people have that? And I plugged the whole quote into Google, and in fact, there's something like 27 companies have their motto, number one in the number two business. Well, this has nothing to do with sex research, and if I were a mature writer, I would leave it out, but I can't help myself. So that's what goes into the footnotes, really. It's me being unable to leave this stuff out. And the photographs, the chapter opener images, that was my publisher's idea. And initially I thought, you know, because the first book was stiff, the cadaver book, I thought, oh, good God, photographs. No, I think that's not wise. But what they meant was, you know, sort of a allegorical or mm-hmm. metaphorical, humorous, suggestive photograph, not an actual photo of something in the book. And it was it turned out to be a wonderful idea, and we've continued that tradition.
Yeah, that's good. That's great. Talk also about becoming a subject along with your husband. And did you have to work hard to convince him?
Did I have to work hard to convince him? Oh, the Dr. Deng trip?
Yeah.
No, he's unbelievably supportive. Plus, he initially, when I heard it was a book about sex research, he stupidly said, "I'll be a volunteer for a subject," thinking, I don't know what he was thinking, that some, you know, beautiful woman would be ministering to him in a laboratory. I don't know what he thought. But then, because he'd set himself up that way, he was ripe for me to come along and go, "You know how you said you'd be willing to participate, and also, by the way, you know, it's been 25 years since you went to London, and I'll pay for everything." So I kind of had the combination of set him up and bribe him. And Ed is very good at putting things completely out of his head until about 4 hours beforehand. So he was fine with it until we got there, and then got up that morning and was just so filled with dread. I felt so awful. Because really the onus of performance was on him. I was taking notes the entire time. And so, you know, it wasn't a big deal for me. But, you know, and Dr. Deng it's ultrasound, so you're not in a scanner somewhere with any privacy. He's actually holding the wand to my stomach to my belly, and you know, so he's reaching over Ed. It was you just had to think of it as a kind one of those things that you endure when you go to the doctor.
Yeah. So are you typically uninhibited? I mean, you must be just so totally uninhibited to take part in your own book and to I don't know.
Am I uninhibited? I'm not a dance on the bar kind of gal. I don't really think of myself as an uninhibited. I guess I'm just very single-minded when it comes to my books, and I can see what will make a fun scene. And then I can see the value in it, and so I just convince myself, well, yeah, what the hell? I don't. it'll be over in 20 minutes. But I'm not particularly uninhibited. I'm not I'm not shy, but I'd say I'm probably average.
Yeah, that's great. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I have a few minutes left with Mary Roach, author of Bonk, published by Norton. Talk about also in terms of doing a book like this or any of your books, how much research do you do before you get down to the writing, or are you researching throughout? And does the research ever, you know, do you ever get stuck in it where you just want it to continue where you know you really should be writing?
Well, I'm doing both. Obviously in the beginning I'm just doing research, but as soon as I have enough material to write a chapter, I start writing, because I find that if I put it off till I'm done with all the research, I create this tremendous pressure, because the more time goes by when I haven't written, the more wound up I get about it, and the more the writing suffers. So I'd rather start writing while I'm researching, and even if I have to mess around with the beginning or end of the chapter to make it fit in a different place ultimately in the book, I just need to feel like I'm getting something written. Otherwise, I feel like research always feels to me like work, but not like accomplishment.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm always trying to do both at the same time.
And then sort of the tone, you have a wonderful, wonderful tone and humor in your writing. And do you find that comes out, that just comes out because that's you, or does it come out more with revision, or how does that work for you?
It's my preferred way to approach pretty much anything. Some things obviously don't lend themselves to that kind of humor, and I'll often write in a much straighter tone for a magazine piece, or for a chapter of the book that's a little more somber. Like in Stiff, there was the chapter that dealt with using the bodies of the victims of a plane crash to figure out what had happened and why the plane had gone down. And so I really would tone it down for something like that. But it's just, for me, it's the most fun way to write, and I'm assuming it's more fun to read.
Mm.
But I do go back and I often go back and try to inject some of that into a passage, but often if it doesn't come out in the writing the first time, it feels a little forced.
Mm-hmm. And what about bookstore events? I think I read something somewhere about you in the bookstore with people sitting there afraid to ask questions, or how it's just a funny kind of situation.
Yeah, bookstore events for this book have been my publicist initially was saying, "Well, Mary, how are you going to stand up in front of a group of 100 strangers and talk about, you know, the distance between the clitoris and the vagina and orgasm during intercourse?" And I said, "Well, I pretty much just the way I wrote it, but with 100 people in the room, I'm just going to talk about it." And people with, I think I've seen one person got up and left, and I don't know, maybe her bladder was full. I don't know why she got up and left. But for the most part, people have been great. They haven't seemed to feel like it was inappropriate or that they didn't know what they were getting into. It's been no problem at all. I find, though, that people often are hesitant to ask questions until one person has asked a question, and then 25 people will ask a question. So it's people are a little slow to get rolling with it, but then I think that then once they realize this is a rare opportunity for everybody to just air all their sort of bizarre questions and curiosities about sex, they really get into it.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. We're at the end of our time. I wonder if you could offer any tips or advice to the writers who are listening.
Tips or advice to writers?
Yeah.
Oh, geez. I think I often tell people, there's a number of things. I would say to trust your instincts as much as you can. I actually I don't show my manuscripts to other writers when I'm working on them. And I don't think that's right. I think that's because I'm chicken. But I think you can go too far with that. And you know, if somebody had said to me with Stiff, you know, Mary, this humor and cadaver thing seems really inappropriate and childish, I would have said, oh, you're right, and I would have taken it all out because I'm so insecure. So I think there's something to be said for trusting your instincts and not necessarily changing, you know, making every change that everyone suggests. I also feel like you gotta really make your writing do work for you. I mean, if a sentence isn't, if people aren't learning anything, or it's not, the writing isn't crafted in a special way, or it's not funny, or it's not illuminating, out it goes. I mean, I think, you know, it's got to earn its keep, a sentence, you know, mm-hmm. to stay. And people sometimes think, well, with a book, well, I've got 300 pages, so I've got to fill them. Well, but you still have to apply the same standards that you would to a short story or a magazine piece or whatever, an essay. I think you can't get lazy with it.
Mm. Thank you so much, and thanks for Bonk.
Thank you. This was really fun.
Thanks. That was Mary Roach. She was speaking to us from Oakland. Her new book is Bonk, The Curious Coupling of Science and Sex, published by Norton. She has a website, which is maryroach.net. So do visit it. There's a link to her events coming up. And anyway, great stuff, great writer, and admirable person. Going to take a break. When we get back, we should have Kathleen Shine with us, so don't go anywhere.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like 1,000 years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Casper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
It's Good News Week. Someone's dropped a bomb somewhere, contaminating atmosphere and blackening the sky.
For thought-provoking dialogue and talks that penetrate Orange County and beyond, listen to Subversity on KUCI 88.9 FM and webcast at KUCI.org. That's Subversity with your host, Dan Tseng, each Monday at 9 a.m. on KUCI.
Listen to Writers on Writing every Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Pacific Time on 88.9 FM. KUCI, in in Irvine.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, still. We were here with Mary Roach the first half, and we're back with Kathleen Shine. Before I bring her on, though, I want to remind you that we are in the midst of a fun drive, and hope that you might call, especially call at the end of the show so I can say hi. The number is 949-UCI-KUCI. Your donation's tax deductible. It'll help keep the lights on, help keep the phones working, and help keep this volunteer staff with a place to go to do shows. Anyway, let's bring on Kathleen Shine. She's the author of The Love Letter and Rameau's Niece, among other novels. She's contributed to The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, The New York Times Magazine, and Vogue. Her new novel is The New Yorkers, published by Picador. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Great to have you on the show. I've been aware of your work for such a long time, and I think where I first became aware of you was in the book by, is it Jill Steinmetz, The Writer's Desk, where there was a photo of you writing.
Oh.
I think sitting on your bed with your son.
Yes.
And that was what a great picture.
Oh, well, yes, I work in bed a lot, and that's where, when my kids were little, that's when my son was just a little boy. They always knew where to find me. They would just come into the bedroom. But I found that the bed was the best desk of all because it's so big. You can spread out all your work.
Do you still work in bed?
Excuse me?
Do you still work in bed?
I often do. I mean, you know, I kind of switch. You know how it is with one. Well, maybe you don't, but I hope you don't. But you know, your back goes in and out, and so I go from. I move around. I'm a migrant worker. I work at the kitchen table. I work at my desk. I work on the couch, and a lot of times I work in bed. It just depends on which part of my back is bothering me at that moment. I move around.
Mm. Let's talk about The New Yorkers. I love this book. I just finished it this morning. I had to finish it before we spoke. And one of the things that I noticed that I found really interesting was that not only is it a multiple point of view novel that works well, but that you begin each chapter with where you're very omniscient. You're real far out, and the more you get into the chapter, the closer, sort of like going from a telephoto lens to, or going from a wide angle lens to a telephoto lens, you pull in as the chapter goes on. Will you talk about the structure and how you came up with that?
Yes, I had been reading a lot of Trollope, which I do whenever possible. It's sort of my I don't know how guilty a pleasure it is, but it's a pleasure. And in the past, I had always saved Trollope as a treat. When I finished a book, I would read a big, fat Trollope novel. And with this book, I was thinking about writing about New York the way I had recently experienced it, having a dog for the first time. I've lived there for over 30 years, and we got this little dog, and my entire experience of the city changed, and I felt like I had discovered this new place, and I wanted to write about it. And one of the things that it made me realize was that New York is really just a collection of tiny villages. And I realized that I was thinking of the city as if it were a small English 19th century village, which, of course, immediately gave me license to just start reading Trollope endlessly. So it was my year of reading Trollope. Everyone was making fun of me. It's all I could talk about. Everything in the world that has ever happened, it's kind of like the Bible. Everything that ever happens, you actually can find it in a Trollope novel. And one of the things as I was reading it that I was noticing was this wonderful narrator that I realize is very natural in 19th century novels. There's an omniscient narrator, but the narrator is also very personal. It's someone who's been to this place, who knows these people, but you don't know exactly how. And I found it very, very interesting, and it seemed appropriate for this book to try to do that. And I had in the past, I've often written from, I began by writing from one very, very specific point of view. My first novel was an autobiographical novel, and it was a very, very limited single point of view, and that's my tendency. But recently, I had sort of moved into having other characters actually tell part of the story, and so I wanted in this book to write really an ensemble piece, really a lot of different characters and their lives and how they intercept through their dogs. And this narrator, this idea of a narrator who was both omniscient and also a part of this in some way, really appealed to me. And as I started writing about it, it started to feel not 19th century at all, but tremendously modern. And it was really difficult and really, really fun. So that's how I came about that. It just seemed right for this book, and also for me, as, you know, with every book, you try to do something. It's not that you try to, but you get excited about something. And that was one of the things that just really, really interested me, was playing around with that. And I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, I enjoyed it too. And I find that one of the most difficult things that new writers try to do is switch point of view, mm-hmm. especially within, say, a chapter. Mm-hmm. You do it so seamlessly, and I don't know if that's one of the things that you're saying was difficult. I'd love to hear about that, because it was very seamless, the way you would just move from one to the next within a matter of paragraphs.
Well, in this book, it was what the book was really about, in some way. It was about these, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, 8 characters, and they're kind of intercepting experience of this one block. So it was very important that I do that, and for this book it wasn't difficult because that's what the book was about in many ways. It was about shifting perspectives and different points of view of the same place, of the same experience, and so it you know, there were times, of course, there always are, when just structurally you have to figure out, you know, who's going to be telling the story now. And there's always that kind of mechanics of writing, which I don't know whether I would call it difficult or just, for me, it's just part of the experience. It's a challenge, but it's not, you know, a particularly difficult thing to do. But it was very, very interesting for me in this book to move around like that. And it made these characters for me on this street really come alive, as each one of them would kind of meet a dog or meet a person on the street, and you'd see it from their perspective, and then later you'd see, oh, well, that dog that we thought was so wonderful is actually very annoying and slobbered on my coat, and that kind of thing. So it, you know, and I have found with, when you write romantic comic novels or comedies of manners or whatever you choose to call what I do, a lot of the comedy comes from misunderstanding, and the most direct way to get to that is to have one point of view of a character who sees everything unfolding and is wrong, you know, and that's who you're, the reader, that's who you're living with, and this person who gets it all wrong and sort of gets corrected in these comic ways. So in terms of writing comic stuff, it was a very different way of doing it, and again, very exciting for me and fun and interesting. And that's, for me, that part of what I'm doing is telling a story, and part of what I'm doing is enjoying myself when I write. And so that's kind of these shifting points of view came about for both those reasons.
Mm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Kathleen Schein, author of the new novel, The New Yorkers, published by Picador. I was wondering how the book would have changed if it was just from one point of view, and it seems incomprehensible that it could be told from one point of view. It would be such a different book.
Well, I think so. Then I think it would have been about one of the characters and his or her experience. And this book is really about a community of people, and it's a funny kind of a community because they're drawn together by nothing. I mean, by nothing that you normally think of, and that's, you know, none of the characters has a last name in this book, and I've never done that before.
Mm-hmm.
And that was very, very conscious, because every time I'd start to think of a last name, it would give these characters a certain amount of baggage, of background, of ethnic background or religious background or geographical background. And I wanted to create this moment that you find in New York City, and I imagine you find it other places too, but I know that you find it in New York, where you take your dog, you go out to walk the dog, and you meet the people who live on your block, and they have nothing to do with you. They don't work with you. They don't go to your place of worship. They didn't go to the same college you went to. They didn't come from the same town you came from. They have nothing to do with you except you live there as neighbors and you're out with your dogs, and you make this connection that is in that moment and that has to do with that place. And it's a very, very special, kind of precious connection, I think, and that's what I was trying to get at. And therefore, not only did these characters not have last names, but it really was about all of them coming together through their dogs, who kind of act as cupids in some cases. There are romances that occur, or friendships, or cases of intense dislike also. So, it would have been a completely different book. It would have been about one person living on New York, rather than about this block and this kind of meta community that that I found very inspiring when I encountered it for the first time in New York.
Yeah. Will you read to us from The New Yorkers?
Will I read something from The New Yorkers?
Yeah, that'd be great.
I would be delighted. I'm going to read, I'll read this, just the prologue. The book is based on, it takes place on a block that is never identified in the book, but is very much inspired by a block that we lived on for some years. So, it's been some years since I lived on the street that figures in this story. It was never one of New York City's fashionable blocks. There are no mansions there. No narrow houses of historical importance, no plaques attesting to former residents of consequence. It was not even a particularly beautiful block. The apartment buildings, though old, were architecturally indifferent. Commercial ventures existed side by side with the street's residents. The brownstones that lined the street were mostly broken up into apartments, and most of those apartments were rentals. It was in this way, the way of the rent-controlled apartment, that the street had largely escaped the sweep of gentrification taking place all around it. Struggling musicians and actors and secretaries and window washers could still afford to live there, and they still did, some of them growing successful, some simply growing old. A government-subsidized senior residence that held AA meetings every Thursday night added to the slightly raffish nature of the place, as did the two churches, in the doorway of each of which could be found its nightly resident homeless person, an enormous but orderly bearded man at the Lutheran church, a disoriented woman on the steps of the Catholic church. A bar at one end contributed to a sparse but constant supply of beer bottles on the sidewalk. The street's proximity to Central Park made it a favorite with professional dog walkers who could hardly be expected to keep track of the waste of the 7 or 8 dogs pulling them forward. And so the street, not distinguished by great beauty to begin with, was not terribly clean either. And yet, it was the loveliest street I have ever lived on, and the most interesting.
Hmm. Wonderful way to begin the book. And by the way, you have prompted me to want to read Trollope, which I never have, and now I'm thinking, what have I been missing?
Well, I don't know if Trollope is an acquired taste or not. I actually, you know, I used to write television reviews for Vogue many, many years ago. And I have to say, because it was a monthly magazine and the only shows that I could ever get to see were English shows that were going to be then on Masterpiece Theater, I got to see, I saw these shows, they were all based on novels, and I mean, it's kind of embarrassing to say, but that's how I started reading Trollope. It was, I guess it was the Palliser novels. Actually, I think that was even before, I'm not sure. But anyway, it was from seeing a Masterpiece Theater series that I saw that was of the Pallisers, and I thought, gosh, this looks so interesting. And I started reading them, and I'm a complete fanatic. I read them over and over and over again. The other books that I read a lot while I was writing this were novels by Barbara Pym, who's a wonderful English novelist who writes about very, very small domestic incidents, and usually often single women, not always. And I really learned a lot about how to observe, and which I was learning at the same time with the dog, walking the dog, how to observe people and just what's around you and the tiny things that end up being terribly important. So those were the two things I was very immersed in as I read the book. And they were also things that I read for comfort. And this, I wrote this book after 9/11, and I really needed comfort. And I felt that I wanted to write a book that would comfort me, which this did. And I wanted to read books that comforted me, which those do. And I also felt very, very protective suddenly of the city, that which I had frankly gotten kind of bored with after 30 years. You know, it was so noisy, and then I, you know, I just fell back in love with it. And the book ended up being a kind of love letter to New York City, and of course to dogs. There are a lot of dogs in the book.
Oh, the dogs are great. The dogs are just great, and people's relationships with the dogs.
Well, that was, you know, I had had dogs as a kid growing up, family dogs, who were wonderful, but I never had until we got this dog that we got. I had never really had that kind of very, very personal, very intense relationship that you have with a dog that you are responsible for and you spend so much time with. And it completely opened up the entire city to me, but it was at the same time this very, very intense personal thing. And of course, the dog, the poor dog that we originally got from the shelter, I wrote about him in the New Yorker, and because that was just a tragedy. I mean, he turned out to be really, really disturbed. I don't know what else to call it. And we spent 18 months kind of trying to deal with him. He was, you know, we travel back and forth from California to New York, and we'd put him under the seat, you know, and you'd be on the plane and you'd suddenly see people tapping on their earphones thinking something, there was static. It was our dog having a dog fight with himself in the case. And I mean, It was. It's funny, but it was also truly tragic. He tore himself apart, and he bit everybody, including us. And it was just, we tried, you know, Prozac. He was taking the same pills. I was Prozac, Xanax, everything, millions of trainers, many, many vets, behaviorists, chiropractors, acupuncturists. And it was my family wouldn't, no one would allow me to, we couldn't visit anyone because he would attack them. And no one could come to our house because he would attack them.
So
and
was
we couldn't
Dolly
leave the house because he would attack himself and we'd come home and his feet would be, oh, it was just terrible.
So was Jolly based on that dog?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I gave Jolly a much happier outlook than Buster, who we finally really, we did have to put him to sleep.
Aww.
After 18 months. And in my last book, She Is Me, I had a dog named Temple, who I gave a very happy life in Malibu with his own assistant taking care of him. So I felt very bad about Buster, so I've tried to. And the book is dedicated to Buster.
Yeah. Well, we have just a couple of minutes left, and I wondered if you could talk just a little bit about, the process of writing, and in terms of outlining and plot. Are you an outliner and a plotter, and do you
I am not.
Do it that way?
The one time I carefully outlined a plot and a book, I got to the end of it, and I looked at it, and I thought, why would I write this book now? I know what happens. It's so boring. And I never wrote it. I have a general idea of characters and of relationships and of things that I want to explore. I mean, usually when I'm writing something, I'm trying to find out more about it and see what happens with different characters in different situations. And that, for me, is part of the pleasure of writing and part of the impulse to write. And so, no, I'm not a good outliner, and I wish I was. I mean, I recently did a kind of comic mystery that was serialized in the New York Times Magazine, and it really would have been, life would have been much easier if I had been able to outline it better, you know, because I tried to, and then I'd get to a certain point, and I'd think, no, that doesn't work, and then I'd have to go back, you know, and change all the other chapters. So with a mystery, with something that really, where a plot really matters, it's very challenging to write the way I do. But it's also kind of exciting. You feel like you're flying by the seat of your pants, and it's very interesting. There are a lot of surprises as I move forward. So.
Mm. One more thing I wanted to mention. I like your a lot of your references in this book, contemporary references, and you talk about one of my favorite Billy Collins poems, which is The Lanyard.
Yes.
I don't know. I just wanted to mention that. When I came across that, I just love that. Lanyard, there's the lanyard.
That poem is just heartbreaking.
Yes.
And Billy Collins, I think, is an amazing poet. And, you know, I heard him once first of all, to hear him read is to fall in love with him. So I join every other middle-aged woman in America who's ever heard him read in having a huge crush on him. But he gets at something that, you know, that is so, he sort of gets at the whole structure of comedy, of joy. I mean, if you follow one of his poems, you understand comedy, first of all, what's funny about the world, and therefore what's beautiful about the world in some way. I'm a huge fan of his. I think he's a very complicated, I know he's very accessible and all of that, but I think he's a very complicated, very deep poet, and I just love his work, and so that was my homage.
Yes, I love that. I love it. I love his stuff, too.
Yeah.
And I love this book, and now I must go look for your other books, and just really, really appreciate you coming on the show. Wonder if you have any just last words for the writers listening.
The only words I have is, if you're a writer, you should write. And I've given that advice to a lot of people, and they find it peculiar sometimes. But I really think that's the only way you find your voice, and the only way you can tell if what you've done is any good, and the only way you can tell if it's what you really want to do, because I've met a lot of people who have ideas, but the process of sitting and doing it does not appeal to them, and in that case, maybe they should be trying something else. So, sit down and write. And the other thing, for people who are blocked, I have found, including myself, you put at the top of the page, you put, "Dear Mom," or, you know, "Dear Henry," you write a letter. That's my secret practical advice. Pretend it's a letter, and then it gets you started. And that sounds very mundane, but it
works.
It works, yes.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. This was wonderful. Thanks so much.
That was Kathy Schein. Her new book is The New Yorkers, published by Picador. Wonderful book. Wish we had more time with her. Bring her on again next time, next book. Anyway, I'm going to leave you now. My website's penonfire.com, and you can reach the blog. You can reach the podcast from there. You can do so much. I'm going to leave you with a quote by Guy de Maupassant, who said, "Talent is a long patience." How true is that? Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book is Pen on Fire. I will see you next time.